You're about to hear part of a show that we did up in Great Barrington on Friday. We had some technical difficulties. We weren't able to go live on the air at the time, so we recorded it for you. You're going to hear interviews with a whole bunch of filmmakers and the actress Mary Kay Place. And then we decided also, you know, why stick only with the Berkshire International Film Festival? Why not check out the biggie, which is Cannes? So we'll talk to Pete Hammond, one of the critics who was at Cannes, about what it's like to go there and try to figure out what the important films are. So hang in there with us. It's kind of a two-part show today. We're live from Great Barrington. We're at the Berkshire International Film Festival. At Cannes this year, they had a rule that you couldn't be on the red carpet if you didn't wear high heels. But we have a red carpet here at the Great Barrington Triplex, and people are in all kinds of footwear and possibly barefoot as well. They have hundreds of movies that they're showing here this year. Only 30% of them feature James Franco. I think that's an all-time low. I don't really keep those kinds of statistics. So we're going to begin by talking to the person who founded this and runs this, and sitting with her, one of the jurors, Mary Kay Place, is here with us, a renowned and beloved actress. And she's so nice, too. She's nothing like on Big Love. She's not that person. She's just the nicest but very sleep-deprived person that you could possibly hope to meet. Kelly Vickery is here. She's the founder also of the festival. Kelly, just start us off here. In fact, I made up numbers there. How many films are you showing in Great Barrington and Pittsfield this year?
Well, overall, we're showing 80 films. We're showing all of them in Great Barrington, and then we take a selection and put them up in Pittsfield as well. So, yeah, 80. That's a record number for us this year.
And meanwhile, Mary Kay Place, you are a juror, as you have been in the past. First of all, how do they get you to come here and be a juror? You don't live in the Berkshires. You're bi-coastal, right?
Because of Cindy Wick and Chan Gibson, who are friends from L.A. and who are friends with Kelly.
And on the advisory board.
That was my connection. This is my fourth year, and it's really, I love coming every year. It's really a great festival.
Before we even plunge into the festival, your many fans want to know what you're up to right now. So you're in a film that's not actually here at the Berkshire International Film Festival, the new Blythe Danner movie. Tell us about that movie.
It's called I'll See You in My Dreams. It's a very simple, streamlined film, but it's about aging, loss, finding joy in your life again. It's really a very nice film.
It sounds like my life, actually. Aging, loss, finding joy. You may be hearing from my lawyers. I'm not getting any residuals from this.
Residuals. Well, yeah. it
premiered at Sundance.
Right.
We wanted it, yeah. But it's already released in theaters, so that goes against the BIFF policy.
Yeah. And what do you play in it, Mary Kay?
I just play a friend of Blythe Danner's. A lot of my stuff was cut, but I think it was a wise choice because it's such a streamlined film. But it's so we all play a bridge once a week or a couple of times a week together. But it's a really nice film.
And you're also going back to Getting On, right?
I'm going back to the HBO show Getting On, and I'm going to do a film this summer, which I can't say the name of yet because we haven't totally closed
it. It's Star Wars.
No. But anyway, I'm excited about it and looking forward to it. And that'll be in the New York area, so that'll be fun.
Oh, good.
Kelly, I'm sort of always looking for themes. So far I've seen three movies, all of which seem to ask the question, is this worth dying for? Is something worth dying for? Last night we saw Meru, which is about mountain climbing. It's about three guys taking these incredible risks and really putting their lives in incredible jeopardy because somehow or other they've made this calculation that it's worth it. I just saw a movie called, I think it's called Above and Beyond. I get the titles.
Yep.
But this is about this sort of makeshift squadron of fighter, bomber, and transport pilots who became the Israeli Air Force in 1948. They were all for the most part, former American service men who just sort of came back. But they also decided, I might get killed, and I don't have to do this. It's not my country, really. But, yeah, this is worth dying for. And then we're going to be talking to the makers later of Frame by Frame, which is about shooting in Afghanistan. So there's a theme, right? Is this worth dying for?
Well, there's a theme. I get, you know, it's people following their passions, a lot of those, and having a higher calling or just having, talking to the filmmakers last night from Meru, or the climbers, I should say, it's just in them. It's just who they are. It's how they live and breathe. And I think Frame by Frame, again, you'll talk to the filmmakers, but that's their passion to tell those stories through their camera. So, sure, that's a theme.
Frame by Frame is about doing photography in Afghanistan post-Taliban, but where it's still this pretty, to be a photojournalist, and it's scary enough anywhere, but in Afghanistan, it's a far more risky thing.
Yeah.
So Mary Kay Place, as a juror,
First of all, are you a juror for narrative this year or for
this
documentary?
This year it's narrative. We alternate every year.
And so what makes its case for you? I mean, in other words, what's going to win your heart the most?
Well, I'm like Elvis. He says, "It don't move me." He would, remarking on a song, he said, "It don't move me." Yeah. I like to be moved. I want to feel something. I want to experience something. I want to be emotionally involved in the story, even if it has nothing to do with my life. I find that a great film and great storytelling, you can relate totally, even if you have no experience with the thing they're talking about. There's a universality about the humanity of the people and the story and the emotions, and that I like to experience something. And I don't like to feel that I'm hearing a structured screenplay that isn't breathing. I like films that talk about humanity, of what it is to be a person and a human being.
And I was saying to Mary Kay before we started, Kelly, it does seem, maybe it's because we're at a film festival, so we're... I think people get especially keyed up here. I mean, I've been in films where people have been profusely weeping. Last night you heard people sort of gasping. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just because people's senses are a little bit heightened because they know they're at a big event. But I feel like people connect emotionally in an environment like this one.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, I think, you know, you get caught up in festivals. I think, you know, music festivals, theater festivals, film festivals. You know, you're here for an experience and to experience, you know, one of the great things about festivals is that you're meeting the filmmakers. The filmmakers are here. You're able to not only see their story on film, but you're also able to talk to them. And I think that creates a connection that creates emotion in and of itself.
You know, Mary Kay, I was asking you before whether being at something like this changes your perspective on film. I mean, you're an actor, but you're also an Academy member, so you pretty much watch everything. But I would assume coming to something like this, you will see a movie that Academy voters will never see, right? There are movies being shown here that are still trying to find their way to people's eyeballs.
That's totally possible, and there's some gems to be seen that may never make it in the wider, across the country, in wider distribution. So there's always a gem and a joy in seeing something that that other people, you might never have discovered otherwise. So it's exciting.
I mean, I find sometimes that I think, well, I'll see a movie here or at another film festival that I'll love. And then a year later, I'll go, wait a minute, where is that movie now? What happened to it? I mean, it seems sometimes sort of fundamentally unfair.
It's tragic at times. But that's the great thing about festivals and Netflix.
Right.
True. Well, I mean, and we'll be talking about this as the show moves along here, too, because, Kelly, I mean, there was just a panel upstairs from here talking about all the distribution methods, all the new platforms. And in a way, I mean, we're living in this great moment where a lot of stuff can get seen by a lot of people.
Right.
But it also feels like a very chaotic moment where stuff can just as easily get lost in this incredible madhouse.
Oh, it does. It absolutely does. And it's, as Mary Kay said, it's, you know, it is the great thing about festivals is because, you know, especially documentaries, it's hard for them to have a life outside of festivals sometimes if they don't get a distribution deal. And these documentaries that we have here should be seen by, in my estimation, absolutely everybody. And certainly shorts you're never going to see anyplace else but, you know, from festivals. But also on the narrative side, there are so many wonderful stories. And these filmmakers, you know, they do their Kickstarter campaigns and they work so hard to get, you know, their story told up on a screen. So, you know, I hope that there's some distribution companies out there waiting to pick them up.
It is interesting, though, with the way the game's changing. I just read this morning that Abel Ferrara, a very well-acclaimed, well-established director, is doing a Kickstarter campaign because he wants the final cut. Mm-hmm. He wants control.
Yeah.
I mean, if you raise your own money. Mary Kay, do you feel as though that kind of changes the equation, that sometimes even a well-established filmmaker can get a little bit more control over his work if you can figure out a different way to get the movie seen?
It's true. The movie we were talking about earlier, I'll See You in My Dreams, mm-hmm. was a Kickstarter film. It was made for $1.49, and it was a beautifully produced film. I mean, we had everything we needed. We had all the time we needed. So it's interesting how there is a life where there's a will, there's a way.
Right.
Well, you have to be smart, right? You have to
to be smart.
You have to figure out everything.
And you have to really want to get it done.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes, I'm sure these guys will tell you, a lot of sacrifice, and just when you think it's going, it doesn't go, and then this falls through and that falls through, and you have to have the strong iron stomach to make it through all that. And I'm sure they'll give you details.
Well, that could be a very good segue. First of all, I know you guys have to move on to your other commitments, but it's been great to visit with Kelly Vickery, the founder of this Berkshire International Film Festival, and to finally get Mary Kay Place on. The jurors are always great. You guys always want to come on, but you actually have
to
be.
But it's a live show, and then we have shows we're supposed to be watching at the same time.
They have a schedule. I keep them working.
Plus, she's had no sleep whatsoever, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Cross-eyed.
Right. So if you see Mary Kay Place dozing off somewhere, please wake her up.
But
and make
never
sure
in a movie.
Never in a movie.
Ever.
It'll never happen. No, but
absolutely
she's on LA
not
time. She got no sleep last night. All right, thanks. We'll let you sneak out, and I'll sort of switch over here while that's happening. We're going to just highlight one particular narrative film right now, and we've got three people from the film here. I'm going to keep talking while we do. This is like hockey. We're going to do sort of a line switch here. We're going to talk a little bit about the movie Don't Worry Baby, one of the narrative films that's being shown here. When we say narrative, we mean sort of essentially a fictional film, a feature film. There are lots of other words for it as well. So joining us now is our Nick Shore, Julian Branciforte, and Tom Kyer. They are all either producers or directors or writers or some combination thereof with Don't Worry Baby. So, Julian, start us off. Tell us, first of all, what Don't Worry Baby is. What is this movie?
It's a movie about a father and son who unknowingly sleep with the same woman, and she has a
child. Wait a minute, that's my life, too.
Yeah. So she has a child, and over the course of a week, they figure out who the father is through a paternity test, and in that time, they kind of compete over the affection of the child. So it's kind of a dark comedy with a father-son competition type of thing.
And give us a sense, one of you, just sort of how long it has taken, what the process has been to bring this movie to the screen. You can't just snap your fingers and make this happen. So what's the journey been like?
We started development on the project back in early 2012. 12. Almost at 13. It's been that long. 3 years.
There's a whole series of decisions that you have to make, and I'd be interested to hear you guys talk a little bit about this. One sense that I have is, well, if you go back to the early 2000s, suddenly because of digital technology and a bunch of other stuff, a lot of people could make $50,000 films, but a lot of them kind of looked like they were $50,000 films because people didn't know what they were doing. But my sense now is that if people are really smart from the very beginning, make every decision based on sort of, you know, what their ultimate back end can be and all this kind of stuff that, you know, she just talked about a film that was made for $1.49, which I think was a metaphor, but but it's a great looking film, right? You can do a film that doesn't look like a $50,000 film now.
Absolutely. You know, the access to amazing equipment, you know, the reality is that we're shooting with the same cameras that, you know, any of the movies that are coming out of Hollywood are shot on. And, you know, just having good locations and good cameras and a good crew, you can get a lot done and make it look great without necessarily spending as much cash as you once maybe needed to.
I assume there are other decisions that you do have to make, though. I mean, for example, if you can get Mary Kay Place to work for you for $1.49 because she loves the project, she's friends with somebody, great. But other than that, you're probably smart not to look for actors who are good actors, who fit the roles, but aren't necessarily people who are going to cost you a fortune.
We weren't really in a position where, like, we could even get any of those actors, you know? I think that everybody that did it just really wanted to be part of the movie, and we had to, like, pick people that wanted to do a guerrilla film. So we weren't trying to look for, like, the biggest actor we could. We were trying to look for the person who wanted to make the film like we did.
Yeah, I don't think we mentioned this, but all of the characters are guerrillas in this movie.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
one thing we did learn was you definitely need to go where the excitement is.
What do you mean by that?
So when we're reaching out to actors, whoever responds, you know, the best at the script is probably the one you want to work with. It'll make your life so much easier.
Unless they're a terrible actor.
And how did you raise money for this? I'm assuming you didn't do a Kickstarter. Did you do conventional kinds of funding sources? Or
We're going to do a Kickstarter.
Yeah, we will be doing a Kickstarter. Yeah. This festival experience is starting to amount to much more than we thought.
What do you mean by that?
Not every festival will put you up or fly you out. We think it's important to attend.
So you're going broke, basically.
Going totally broke.
And so has this process, I don't know, does it make you want to make another movie? They were just, over that panel, they were sort of saying that even Robert Benton said, you know what you're doing when you're making a movie? You're thinking about your next movie. You're making a movie that will allow you to make your next movie. Is that kind of the place you guys are at?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking like that when I was making the film. It's my first film, but that is very much the case.
Well, the movie is Don't Worry Baby, which is a great title, except that when you Google it, you get the Beach Boys song.
Yeah, it's all right.
They copied us.
Things could be worse.
Yeah, there could be worse problems. All right, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Colin.
We're going to grab a break. We're going to come back with more.
Hoping things would work out right. And that's why God made the movie.
We are live from the red carpet of the Brookshire International Film Festival. When I say red carpet, the carpeting happens to be red here, but it sounds more glamorous anyway. We are going to talk to, we have a cast of thousands, as usual, here for the Brookshire International Film Festival. We're up in Great Barrington. If you're hearing this on Friday night, you can get down and see some movies on Saturday and Sunday. If you're hearing this on Monday or whatever other day, you missed a great festival, or if you're listening on the internet. But you also can track down these movies, because all of them will find distribution if they haven't already, and you'll have great experiences with them. Let me tell you a little bit about who's here right now, if I can figure it out. From the documentary Frame by Frame, Alexandria Bombach, director, producer, and Mo Scarpelli, who's our co-director. Co-director? Got that right? Courtney Mom, she's a co-writer for Bob in the Trees, which is, we'll have to explain it. I won't be able to explain it in any short way. Then also from the movie Romeo is Bleeding. This is a documentary. Michael Klein, the producer. Jason Zeldis, the director. I got through the introductions.
Good job.
Yeah. Woo. Okay, that's all we have time for, but thanks for coming by. Anyway, that was great. One of the things that we were talking about in the first segment, one of the themes that I sort of see running through a lot of the movies that I'm seeing so far here, is that whole question of, is this worth dying for? Is it worth dying to climb this mountain? Is it worth dying to go back into war after World War II and become an Israeli fighter pilot? So, Alexandria, one of your characters or one of your protagonists in your documentary flat out brings this up. I think the woman says, I might die being a photographer in Afghanistan, but it's worth it, right?
Yeah, Mo and I followed Farzana, and she's an amazing person and has a lot of courage, and I think she feels an immense responsibility, and we just spent a good month with her at different film festivals talking to her about that, and it's hard for her. I mean, she's a normal human just like the rest of us, but with the experience that she's had through the Soviet regime, through the Civil War, through the Taliban, she's been through it herself, and she knows how important it is to share these voices.
And Mo, as you guys were following Afghanistan's photojournalists often into some of the trouble spots that photojournalists go rushing into, did you feel as though you had to ask yourself this question too? Like, this is actually, I'm in a dangerous place sometimes. Is this worth doing?
Yeah, I think both Alexandria and I come from a place of hearing about Afghanistan mostly through headlines, you know, through suicide attacks and explosions. Everything sounds so crazy all the time, but really we get there and we find that normal life goes on. People are shopping for fresh fruit in the markets, and people are, you know, having a peaceful moment of prayer by themselves, and people are living life. And so a lot of our experience, actually, and a lot of what is reflected in the film, is this Afghanistan you don't usually get to see. We do follow the photographers. We do run after them into, you know, the things they're covering, which sometimes are suicide attacks. But, you know, these photographers also go home and have tea and go to the grocery store and do all the other things. And so you really get to know them as humans in their normal everyday life alongside this, like, the insidious risks of being a journalist in Afghanistan.
The other thing that I was struck by watching the movie is, I mean, one of the tensions in the documentary is that photography was essentially taken away by the Taliban. I mean, it became a forbidden thing, even to own photographs. You know, they would show up and rip up your photographs and stuff like that. And that it is, to quote Joni Mitchell, sometimes you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And that in some ways here in this country, you know, we often are having little battles. We've been having little battles where I come from, with the government and with the police, about what photos the press can have access to. And these are really important. One of your characters, Alexandria, says, I keep calling them characters, they're actual people. One of your photographers says, if you don't have photography, you don't have a culture, right?
Yeah, he says, without photography, we don't have an identity. And that was a huge exploration in the film for us, because we wanted to not only capture what that had meant to have that ban of photography for that time, but what it means now that they're able to have this fledgling free press, and what it means for the country. And most of all, what it means to tell true stories and capture not only the war and what's going on, but an entire culture, like showing every aspect of life and what that means to them, and that other Afghans get to see that and celebrate that too, and celebrate the good things, but also have a voice for a lot of the problems.
I haven't seen Romeo is Bleeding yet. It hasn't been shown at the festival yet. But I sense there are some common themes here, right? There are some real questions, yes, about cultural expression, what it can do. First of all, maybe just, Jason, you can begin to sort of sketch out the movie for people.
Yeah, of course. So Romeo is Bleeding follows a young poet from Richmond, California, which is outside of Oakland in the Bay Area. And Richmond has had a turf war in the black community stretching back to World War II. So Dante is the youngest son of one of the most notorious gangsters from the north side of town.
And he started writing about all of these traumatic experiences he'd witnessed or lived through, and he became a locally famous poet in the Bay Area. And that's where we pick up the story after he had founded this arts organization called Raw Talent. So we follow him over the course of the school year as he takes, he and all of his students take the experiences that they lived through in their environment and adapt it into a modern day Romeo and Juliet set in Richmond, California, as a healthy way to process the challenges that they face on a day-to-day basis.
Michael Klein, my sense is, I don't know if you were hearing common themes as they were talking, but this, both of these movies are about sort of clashes between culture and violence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually just got to see Frame by Frame this morning, and it was fantastic. And I saw it with DeAndre Evans, who's one of the subjects in our film, who lives in Richmond and is going through the same thing. And Richmond is however many thousands of miles away from Afghanistan, but he connected in the same way. And he's like, the way that they express themselves through photography and how we express ourselves through poetry, it's the same thing. How you talk about it in your film, that photography is a universal language, art is a universal language, and self-expression. And so it's definitely a very similar...
Art is activism.
Yeah,
in both of these films, very much alive and present.
Okay, we've got one more member of the panel. I want to get her into the conversation. We talked a lot last night at the opening party. Courtney Maum is here. She's co-writer of Bob and the Trees. Well, first of all, this is a movie that has an unusually strong connection to where we are right now.
It absolutely does. It was filmed in the town we live in, Sandusfield, which is about a half hour from here, and it features completely local talent except for one actress that we imported.
Although this isn't as violent or dangerous a place as Afghanistan or Richmond can be, after our conversation last night, I'm pretty sure we're here in Twin Peaks right now. I mean, this is...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's about... Bob and the Trees is about logging and loggers. And logging, I think, after crab fishing, is the second most dangerous occupation in America. Although having seen Maru last night, I now think rock climbing... Well, let's just not even talk about rock climbers. But, so we're really proud to be here because this is our home.
And tell us about the movie.
So the movie Bob and the Trees is about Bob, a real-life logger. He's in his mid-50s, and he's very much a last man standing in the sustainable forestry industry. And he's trying to do his things his way, but not the modern way. He doesn't understand how the internet works. He doesn't have a web presence. And he's losing business to some upstarts around town who are more willing to outsource the wood and the offshore logging, and they don't have as much of a problem with it. And in order to keep up with a really particularly hard winter when the fuel prices are way too high, he makes an incredibly risky business decision that puts his family and his business in peril.
You know, I want to talk to all of you about this, although I'm getting a very serious-looking signal from Kelsey Bissell. I'm going to have to stretch this a little bit because this is an important thing to talk about, and this is something that they can all talk about a little bit. But, Courtney, I'm going to stay with you for a second. One of the things that I think is coming up for people who watch films that are documentaries or narratives that are kind of documentary-like is sort of the blurring of those distinctions. And, like, I watched the Kurt Cobain documentary on HBO recently, and I'm thinking, I can't even figure out what's animated, what's added, what's real, what's not real. So you guys had to make a decision about this movie, right?
We had to make a lot of decisions, and I'm actually a fiction writer, and so I wrote the movie with my husband, and it was tough because I wanted to put more fictional elements in. I wanted to add inciting incidents and really create a narrative, and he wanted to really pare it down and make it as lifelike as possible. And he won, and he was right. And I think when you watch the film, it's interesting to me looking forward in film, in cinema, where we'll go with casting. Not me, but in general, because there's so many non-actors giving such vital performances that you can't necessarily get out of. Actors are not in the same way, and we had a really authentic performances because people were living their own lives. So it is, it's a smoothie of narrative and nonfiction, and I think it's tasty.
How did that seems like a
can
blurb.
Can I take that back, please?
No,
terrible
no.
word.
No, I think that's going to be the blurb for the movie.
Oh,
actually,
no.
It's a smoothie of narrative and nonfiction, and it's
brought to
very
you by
tasty.
Jamba Juice.
sorry, Diego, forgive me.
You guys have to struggle with this. I mean, every documentary I see now, obviously, there are things that you can show in real time, things that you have to do added footage with. I'd be interested to know from both teams here, sort of how you guys approach that question.
about the style of putting the film together.
Yeah.
Well, one asset that we had is that we're following poets. And honestly, now that I've made a film about poets, I don't know any other way to make a film because they're already in such a visual and visceral way describing their environment and giving poetic license to the city that they come from, the challenges they face in their life. And that kind of gives us, the filmmakers, poetic license to interpret it using whatever we have at our disposal, whether that's like stylistic recreations of the play they put on or beauty shots of their city or verite or archival. So in the end, our film kind of becomes, well, a smoothie, now that that's thrown out there. And that's what I love about documentaries right now is that, you know, you're getting at a deeper truth, but you can use anything at your disposal in order to deliver that truth in the most effective way.
Yeah. I'm getting a message from the Bob and the Trees people that they now actually control that term, that you are you are free to call your movie a puree.
I've already made, I have hashtagged. I actually would prefer to have puree.
We're cold-pressed juice then.
Right, that's fine. Root vegetables figure in our film, so it's no
fruit.
Can
fight this out afterwards. I don't want anything that ugly happening on the air. So, Alexandria and Mo, can you give us a sense for you guys? I mean, having watched the movie, I didn't really feel like you had to do a lot of recreations. You'd be exciting things are sort of happening in real time.
I think photography was such an inspiration for us. Our photographer's photography is so powerful and that's so strong that it was a really great guidance and also a challenge for us in our own cinematography to make it try to match it. And so that was a big part of like when we were going out and shooting, thinking about setting things up in a way where it matched the magnificence of their photography.
Yeah, and I think also because they're journalists, there was an obligation to show, maybe beyond the fact that Afghanistan is just beautiful, like what we shot, we don't want to alter it. We just want to show you what we saw and what they saw. And so there was, you know, that kind of keeping in line with the same, like, journalistic, I guess.
Yeah, you had a lot to work with. Yeah, it was pretty obvious. All right, I would like to talk about this for another 10 minutes or so, but the ruthless Kelsey Abyssal is giving me that signal. Thanks so much to all of you. Keep your eyes peeled for Bob in the Trees and Frame by Frame and Romeo is Bleeding. We're here at the Berkshire International Film Festival. It's in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. We've never done this before, I think. We've been up here for 4 years now, but we've never really devoted a segment to shorts, to short subjects, or to the shorts that you wear on your body. But this is about short subjects. This is about short films. We have four filmmakers here. We almost had three Todds. As of last night, it seemed like we would be able to book three different director, writer, producers, all named Todd, all making short films. But the whole thing fell apart. It's with the lawyers now. So with us is Todd Kruger. He's a director, writer, producer for Exposure. Todd Kipp from Consolation Prize. He's a director, writer. Reynaldo Marcus Green, director and writer of Stop. And Claire Seckler, writer and producer, and I think everything else too, for Humpty. Very quickly, I'm going to have you sketch out these films. Many of the films that we've talked about today appear to be based on my life. Todd Kruger, I think your film is based on my life as well. Tell us what it is.
Yes, Exposure is about a guy and a girl with social anxiety disorder that get set up by their therapist to meet at a speed dating event. And much like what your life was like, awkwardness ensues.
Yes, actually. And Todd Kipp, tell us about Consolation Prize.
Consolation Prize is a drama. It's about this deadbeat dad who lives on this wasteland of wrecked cars and trucks, and he gets this surprise weekend visit from his son and carries on from there.
Actually, I live on a wasteland of cars and trucks, too. So, I think this might be some kind of dream I'm having, you know, or a Truman Show thing. Claire, tell us about Humpty.
Humpty is a short film that I wrote and directed, and it's about a young couple with an unexpected pregnancy. And when the boyfriend realizes his girlfriend doesn't think he's ready to be a dad, he decides the best way to prove to her that he is to retake a high school parenting test he failed and carry an egg around for a week.
All right. And Ronaldo, tell us about Stop.
Stop is about a young man who's stopped by the police on his way home from practice. And it's dealing with stop or frisk policy in New York City and racial profiling.
It really is fresh as today's headlines just in terms of what we've been talking about as a nation right now in racial disparities. I want to just get all of you to talk a little bit about short films and where they live. You know, I mean, they live ideally on the Oscar nominee reels that everybody goes to see. But where else do short films, like Claire, where does your film live? Where do people get to see it for the most part?
Sure. Humpty's been going around festivals a bit, which is great. It's really fun to go to different communities and screen it for such disparate audiences. We're also going to be on PBS in the fall, which is really exciting. We got picked up by a program called Film School Shorts with KQED. So that's going to be probably the most broadly available location on there and then online.
Todd Kruger, how about you?
You can see Exposure at my parents' house. No, it's hard to get the shorts out there. I've been doing the festivals too, which is really fun, but that's for like dozens of people at a time.
Yeah.
It's hard to get shorts out there, and the very few distribution channels that approach us are, you know, it's like we can get you to 100 people at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Oscars, it's like that's such a long shot, and you have to jump through a lot of hoops. For me, I'm going to throw it up on my website that I'm creating this summer that kind of advertises me as a filmmaker. But other than that, you know, it's just me trying to whore myself out. It's probably hard to find, but I'd love to show it to the whole world if possible.
Well, maybe we could host it on the WNPR website.
All right, cool.
Well, you know, I mean, this gets to a point, though, Todd Kipp, which is, I was talking to some other filmmakers here today, people that we've talked to in the past, and they're here with a different film, and there was a panel upstairs talking about some of the new platforms where, you know, where, and they were sort of saying, well, you know, there are some people who want to make a movie because they've seen other movies, and so they want to make a movie like the other movies that they've seen, and they want people to see it the way that they saw all the other movies. This guy was saying to me, you know, if I'm going to make a movie in an era where people are watching movies on their phones, on Vimeo, so I'll make that movie. I mean, in some ways, you kind of do have to change with the game. And at that level, the short film may have kind of an advantage. If films are going to become more like MP3s, good to be short. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, they've been talking a lot about where it's going to live, but because the new audiences are just finding it on their phones and things like that, it's not really realistic to think, hey, I'm going to make a film and it's automatically going to play in a theater. Mm-hmm. Your audience is much larger online, no question.
Ronaldo, why choose the short film format? I mean, this is a topic you could have gone 85 minutes on, right?
I don't think it was an 85 minute. This was an incident, a specific isolated moment. I thought it fit well in the short form. A longer movie, I don't think it would be one sort of dramatic incident in a, mm-hmm. in a long form. I don't think it could. It could be a subplot of a larger movie, but mm-hmm. this particular, it fit this format. This was also part of a third year project at NYU Grad Film, which was to create a short film, mm-hmm. To do it for no money. So it was a specific thing. And I think it's going to live online. It was picked up at Sundance by Condé Nast, and it's on their site. But I think it really is up to the filmmaker to push the film as much as they possibly can as well. So how aggressive you are in trying to identify partners for your film and trying to get an audience for it. So I think, you know, it's just as much creative for the, you know, for the filmmaker to go out there and try to find partners and then get it to a broader audience. So that's something that I'm doing with my film now, not just Condé Nast, but how do I get an international distributor to see my film? Because there's other countries that might want to see my movie.
Does anybody else want to say anything more? I feel like this is a good time in a way, just because there are so many different possibilities. You know, there are so many different ways that people, and I really do feel as though consumption of movies is going to switch a little bit, that the younger generation is not going to be necessarily really, really as eager to go put their bottoms down in a movie theater.
Yeah, if we're talking about the commercialism of film, but, you know, one of the wonderful things about going to these festivals is we meet other filmmakers that made their projects purely for the art. And when film started, there were no features or shorts. They were just movies because they weren't classified yet. And then people realized how to make money off of them, and they put them into these convenient categories of certain lengths. Mm-hmm. And so now short films aren't distributed in a way that people can see them. So if you make a short film, chances are, you know, your main priority is to be true to the artist within as opposed to commercialize it. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you're talking about in terms of getting people to see it, it's going to be easier to communicate with people in short form, but I don't think any one of us were thinking, we got to get those 12-year-olds to watch our movies on their iPhones. You know, we were just trying to be artists. And then after the fact, it's like, hey, can I make money doing this?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the other part of it for you, people with social anxiety disorder, they don't want to go to the movies anyway. They want to watch it, in as private a way as possible.
That's true.
Yeah. Does anybody else want to sort of reflect on what's being said here? I mean,
we've been talking a bit at BIFF about these topics of like where things are going. Everyone's always wondering where the film industry is going. Is it going to be like the music industry? Is it going to change? Is everything going to be online? Is it going to be small viewing formats or larger? And it doesn't seem to have chosen yet. So we're all sort of playing fast and loose and trying different things. And people are trying web series. They're trying shorts. They're trying branded content is becoming a bigger form of making money for filmmakers. And then I think most people seem really excited about television and film still in terms of like long-term thinking. But there are so many venues and areas you can play now. So it's really fun. It's fun to try all different kinds.
Yeah, I do think short films are becoming more and more exotic, and attention spans are just
you know, becoming shorter and shorter. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge opportunity, and I realized that this year selling my film at a major festival was like, who buys short films? That was something that wasn't really happening before. Mm-hmm. So I think there's more, and short films are being commissioned by lots of people now. So it is a huge opportunity for people because cameras are getting cheaper and cheaper. Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity for lots of people to start making film. I think the film festivals help to curate that process, which is wonderful. So I think once there's a partnership between sort of the film festivals and the distribution companies to say, hey, we're going to start curating that content and then getting a platform to get online, you know, you're going to see, you know, lots more sales go up for short films. But I think there's a huge opportunity for filmmakers in the short film form.
It's a great way to showcase your talents and your interests.
Well, Kelsey Bissell is holding up only one finger now. That's a bad thing. So I'm just going to encourage people to go and seek out shorts. It's all her fault. Talk to her. I'm going to encourage people to seek out shorts and particularly to seek out Exposure, Consolation Prize, Stop, and Humpty. And those, all of those things can be organized into one single sentence. I'm just not able to be able to. There's a verb. I feel like we could probably do it anyway. And thanks very much to these filmmakers for coming here. And thanks very much once again to the Brookshire International Film Festival. Yeah. We come here every year.
Thank you so much.
And we always have a good time.
Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe with help from Katie Tolarski, Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Alex Dubin, Deborah Timms, and Jules Lefevre. The part of Bill Curry was played by Mary Kay Place. For stories, guest photos, and show pages, visit our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, why do bad things happen, and why do we sometimes really enjoy it when they do? And now, back to Colin.
One thing that I can tell you, because I'm back here in Connecticut now, is that after we talked to the makers of Romeo is Bleeding up in Great Barrington, it won the Best Documentary Award, the juried award in the Brookshire International Film Festival. So that's a little follow-up. Now we're going to talk to Pete Hammond. He's a critic and columnist for Deadline, and he's one of the people who goes to Cannes. First of all, I've always been a little uncertain, Pete, about how to say this. Is Cannes how you say it?
You can say Cannes, or you can say Cannes, but it's really somewhere in the middle there. It's sort of Cannes.
All right. It's always wrong. Whenever you say a French word, it's always
I know.
Slightly wrong.
I tend to, like, shorthand, I keep saying Cannes, but that's an American kind of thing.
Right.
That's not really how they say it.
Right. Yes, I think it causes your order at the restaurant to be delayed slightly.
Very much, yes.
So, and to that point, maybe even before we get into the nitty-gritty of the films served up at Cannes this year, what's it like to be a critic at Cannes? What's your day? What are your days and nights like in that environment?
Well, it's pretty much sleep deprivation city, is what I call it, because for me, it starts in the morning. The very first movie they show is at 8:30, and that's generally the first press screening of the day. And it fills that big, you know, where they have the premieres at night. That's the same theater that the press will see the movie in at 8:30 in the morning or various other times. But it's like 2,000 seats, and it fills at that hour. You know, you're just in a different world. I call it a French fog when you're at the Cannes Film Festival, because it's nonstop from that point. And I can see up to four or five movies a day, depending on the day. And the last one maybe around 9:45, 10 o'clock at night, if you're, you know, on that kind of schedule. And then there's all these dinners, our parties for the movies, you know, because they will have two premieres a night in Cannes. It's like going to the Oscars twice every night on that red carpet. And they have parties generally after those for some of the bigger movies. And I get invited to a lot of those. So I will show up at those, even if I saw the movie at 8:30 in the morning or the night before. Sometimes they have press screenings. And then there's interviews and all sorts of things you're doing there. And you're running up and down that Croisette all the time, in my case with a heavy briefcase. So I like to go what I call on the Cannes diet, because I usually lose a few pounds doing that festival, oddly enough. being in France where all the food is. So, but I tend to eat at the Steak and Shake or McDonald's more often than not at 1:30 in the morning.
Also, not a good way to lose weight. But so yeah. You have this kind of convergence of this almost kind of manic pace, people's heightened emotions, parties that you're going to, many films that you're seeing per day. And it kind of raises a question, which you raise in your own piece, about whether this is a place to be really clear-headed about, you know, what the great films of the coming year are. You know, you mentioned Foxcatcher last year as being a movie that kind of emerged in Cannes. And, you know, it never really quite, I mean, it got some Oscar nominations, but it never quite got traction, you know, with an American film going public. It's almost as if there's sort of a Franco bubble there James Franco
enough,
bubble.
It's more of a European movie in its tone and its pace, and I think that's why it did so well there, and it won the Best Director Award for Bennett Miller. And ultimately, the Academy itself liked it, and they liked Bennett Miller. But I think you're right. I think with the general public, I think the movie was a bit of a head-scratcher. And so, you know, but this is clear of a lot of movies that are accepted into Cannes in the competition and that sort of thing. It's much different. You know, they're looking at it from a different point of view, and it's really an art house festival. I'd say the most of the movies that play outside of the market are a couple of movies that they do to get the glamour thing, like Mad Max Fury Road, or that are out of competition, or Disney Pixar's Inside Out, which was there this year, which is a terrific movie. Very commercial movies, and they like to do that too, but their general fare at Cannes is very art house, very independent-minded kind of cinema.
And so you do have these favorites that emerge. I mean, this year it really does seem to have been Carol, right? This is a picture directed by Todd Haynes.
I think there's
Haynes.
A few films in terms of what will go on. You know, this is hard because for a distributor, if you have a movie like Carol, it's not scheduled to open till mid-December in the United States. So that's a long time to keep this going. So it's going to have to go travel the fall film festival circuit, too, to keep it alive in the game there until it gets opening. Because Cannes is, you know, it got a lot of splash out of Cannes, but that wears off pretty quickly once you get into the fall and all of these movies start opening that are Oscar contenders. But I would say definitely in terms of critical reception, Carol was probably the best one in terms of Oscar potential. However, it didn't win many prizes from the jury. It only tied for Best Actress with Rooney Mara, which was surprising to me because really Cate Blanchett is terrific in that film, and I thought if they're going to have a tie for Best Actress, it would have been between her and Rooney Mara, but she got nothing, and the picture got nothing after that, too. So that was a little bit surprising that it didn't do better with the Cannes jury, which was run by the Coen brothers this year.
We should mention this. So this is sort of a period 50s lesbian romance between Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, right?
Yes, from Todd Haynes, who's obsessed with the 50s, by the way, because he did a terrific film with Julianne Moore called Far From Heaven a few years ago.
Another forbidden romance, too.
Yes, exactly, and also dealt with some gay themes, too. This movie is exceptionally well made, as was that one, I think. And it's this one, Todd, I talked to him at their party, and he said, well, this one's different because this is set in the early 50s. This is set in 1952, and he thinks that's a different period than 1957 when his other one was set. But nevertheless, the guy's obsessed with the 50s, and he does well with female performances. He's kind of like harkens back to those great female directors of the 40s and 50s, like George Cukor or Douglas Sirk, or those who gave great roles to women. And that's what this movie's really doing as well. And look, there's a kind of a hot love scene. I wouldn't say it's like Blue is the Warmest Color, the great lesbian movie that won the Palme d'Or a couple of years ago, but I would say it's pretty hot considering you're looking at Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, you know, mainstream actresses doing that. So I think that'll cause a little bit of a stir maybe when it opens here. Who knows?
Nothing will ever replace Mulholland Drive in my heart. But we shouldn't be talking about this anyway. So we're talking to Pete Hammond right now. So great to talk to you about Cannes. So, you know, the other thing that happens, I think, in this heightened emotional Franco bubble of Cannes, and also just sort of the way an international art house oriented audience is going to react to films, is you not only get these waves of positivism about certain films that may or may not be able to sustain that, but I think you also get these kind of hysterical rejections of films.
Yeah.
So Gus Van Sant, who's, you know, ordinarily a darling over there, his film was roundly booed, right?
Well, you know, that was an interesting thing, and I was, like, on the other side of the fence on that movie. I really liked it, and I sat there in that press screening, and mind you, when you say roundly booed over there, you're talking about roundly booed at the end of a press screening at 8:30 in the morning. It got a 2.5-minute standing ovation at its actual premiere in Cannes, but what gets reported is because they allow the press to go whole hog before they even get to those premieres, it was killed by the critics. They just pounced on it, and I thought the movie worked for me. As I watched it, no one walked out. There was no derisive laughter. The movie was fine, and all of a sudden you heard this huge wave of boos at the end, and it made no sense, because usually if they're going to boo, you see people walking out a lot in Cannes, and I saw nobody walking out of that movie. So I was surprised. I think the filmmakers were very surprised. I think it was a concerted effort probably to influence the jury, because a lot of jury members come to those press screenings too. And for whatever reason, it's a sentimental movie. It's a different kind of movie. It's Gus Van Sant. And now Gus has won the Palme d'Or before. He's beloved in Cannes. He comes many times with his films. But the kind of Gus Van Sant film they like is more like Elephant, which won the Palme d'Or, which is very minimalist filmmaking, the kind of thing that the critics there, particularly the French critics, like, or a movie that's actually, I think, pretty much unwatchable called Jerry, which is Matt Damon and walking across the desert for 2 hours. Those kind of movies play well in Cannes with certain kinds of critics and the critics at these screenings. So they didn't see that kind of movie here. They saw a very sentimental kind of film, Matthew McConaughey, quite different. But I like the film a lot, and actually I think once it finally opens, probably not this year, I would say they're going to try to distance it as much as they can from this festival. This is the risk when you go to Cannes. You know, you may have great, you know, times like Gus Van Sant did with Elephant and win the Pinnacle, win the Palme d'Or, or you may be right down at the bottom. And I think he was really hurt by it. I saw him at the party after their good screening that they had, and he stayed a few minutes, but then he was gone, and even the other filmmakers there and everybody were looking for him, and they couldn't find him. So I think he was a little down about that reception and quite taken by surprise, quite frankly. But I didn't think it was deserved, but that's Cannes for you, you know. They love, and that wasn't the only movie that got booed, by the way. There were boos in several others, but that one was the one that made the news.
We should say that this is Matthew McConaughey and Ken Watanabe. It's about a forest in Japan where people go to commit suicide, and they're both there on that mission, and they meet up.
Yes, exactly, and it's very ethereal, this movie. It's very spiritual. It definitely will have an audience. It's very tough to recover from something, because the perception becomes the truth. And the perception now is that it was booed at Cannes and it was terrible at Cannes, and, you know, what are you going to do? So the marketers here have a challenge to wipe that memory away. And quite frankly, the critics used it as an excuse to pile on. I thought it was quite unfair. But, hey, that's just me, you know.
Hey,
we saw that this weekend with Cameron Crowe, too. You know, they want to build you up, and then they want to tear you down, and they're in the tear-down mode right now of Gus Van Sant and Cameron Crowe with Aloha. Critics can be very mean.
Oh, absolutely, and social media makes it even worse. Hey, yeah. We've only got about a minute left, Pete Hammond. I want you to have a chance to toot the horn of whatever movie you really love that you can't wait to come to the U.S. so you can take your friends and say, I saw this at Cannes.
Yeah,
it was great.
Well, you know, there are a few, but I would point out a movie called Youth, which Fox Searchlight picked up, and they're going to release it, and it's their big Oscar movie. It's Michael Caine, who's just going to get an Oscar nomination for this. He's 82 years old. He's terrific, with Harvey Keitel, and they're two old guys that go to this spa in Switzerland and sort of ruminate on life and things. And then there's Jane Fonda, who shows up in the middle of the movie for about 7 minutes and just knocks it out of the park as an aging, bitter actress, a two-time Oscar winner who really nails it to Harvey Keitel, who's a director trying to get his creative juices going for a new movie that she is now refusing to star in, and she's done all of his movies. Anyway, it's really good. Rachel Weisz is in it. Paul Dano's in it. It's a different kind of movie. Paolo Sorrentino directed it, the Italian director, but it's in English, and he won an Oscar a couple of years ago for The Great Beauty. I would say look for that movie. I really was impressed with that one, as well as a movie called Sicario with Benicio del Toro and Emily Blunt. It's a drug cartel movie, very strong, that Lionsgate releases in September in the U.S. So that's one to look for to come into America.
Pete Hammond, great coverage from Cannes, and thank you so much for joining us, Pete Hammond from Deadline. We'll have to talk again in the future. This has been great.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Won't you watch this movie for me?